And we're talking, of course, as being the very tragic 26th anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing. Just unbelievable that so much time has gone by. So much time. Anyways, we're going to come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM, 21 years. And Wendy Painting is our special guest, and Holland Venden Neuenhoff, who is the director and creator of the film A Noble Lie, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Wendy Painting with us, Holland Venden Neuenhoff with us as well. And Wendy, let's wrap up, first of all, the conviction, and then the, of course, lethal injection that happened so quick. Are you saying that McVeigh pushed this along a little faster than normal, or what happened there?
He did. He wanted that sped up, and it was an extremely quick wait on death row, as you said. But so there's still stories, right, floating around the internet that McVeigh's execution was faked. Kind of like Elvis, Tim McVeigh still roams the earth, and those are easy to dismiss. But there's some funny circumstances, not humorous, not ha-ha funny, but, you know, strange circumstances surrounding this execution. First of all, about 3 weeks before the actual execution, there had originally been a date in May, and it was postponed, actually, because the FBI said, oh, we forgot to give the defense team these documents, and so they postponed it. John Ashcroft postponed it until June of 2001. But on the day of the originally scheduled execution, the Weekly World News released a picture of McVeigh dead on a morgue slab, and that's, you know, okay, that could have been doctored. Mm-hmm. Here's where it gets weird. McVeigh himself had been telling, basically from the time of his arrest, had been telling various, not all of them, because the defense team was rather large, but certain members of the defense team, that he wasn't really going to be executed, that at the last minute, his handlers were going to come for him, and because he had kept his mouth shut. And he actually kind of didn't keep his mouth shut, because he did admit that other people were involved, but that was supposed to stay private. Anyways, I talked to one of the attorneys on the defense team, and he called it the Bourne scenario, and that's what he said. Until his dying day, McVeigh entertained this possibility that he would be spirited away at the last minute. But then if you look at the actual executioner himself, Alan Dorhoff, his name was, well, this guy was put on the stand in a separate, unrelated case in 2007, and Dorhoff, it turns out, had been the subject of over 20 malpractice suits, and his right to medicine had been revoked by at least two hospitals. He'd been reprimanded on a number of occasions by the state medical board. He was on the stand in 2007 because of one of the many botched executions that he had performed. And when he was asked, do you use precise measurements in administering the drugs, you know, used during your executions? He said, heavens no, I'm dyslexic. He quote unquote said, heavens no, I am dyslexic. And then he said he just wasn't good at math. And he admitted on the stand in 2007, and actually, these records were part of a separate lawsuit, had nothing to do with Oklahoma City, but this is how we know, because for a long time they were under seal. But he admitted on the stand that he kind of just made up the process willy-nilly as he went along. And so this is how you get a situation where the least competent executioner in the United States kills America's most notorious terrorist at the time. And so when you look at stories, you can begin to understand, even if they weren't true, where they might come from, or where, you know, there are things to suggest. Now, I would personally, and this is all speculation on my part, let's just say for the sake of argument that something very strange had happened, And for whatever reason, whatever kind of media spectacle or show that was needed, the execution was faked. I personally believe whoever did that wouldn't have kept him alive very long after that. If he was some kind of guinea pig, they would want to shore up their experiment, get their money's worth, and, you know, there really would be no reason to keep him around. But, you know, I have talked to people who are insistent that Timothy McVeigh roams the earth. I don't go that far, but I do say that if you look at these narratives and then you really look at the circumstances surrounding it, they don't sound as kooky as it first sounds when you first hear something like that.
And talking about strange, Wendy, tell us about the tie-in with Area 51 and the possibility of UFOs. What's this all about?
Okay, well, I want to I need to set this story up.
All right.
And so one of the big things that came out after McVeigh's arrest was, Timothy McVeigh said he had a microchip in his rear end. And Timothy McVeigh himself would publicly deny this. Now, according to statements by friends, by fellow soldiers, on a couple of occasions, people on the defense team, Timothy McVeigh had actually been telling that story right before he got out of the Army. He started to say, I think that they put a chip in me. I think they put a chip in me. And he had told this story privately for years. And So just keep that in mind as I transition into this this UFO story. Timothy McVeigh had said that he had been to Area 51, and he said that he was just there to check things out, you know, like people did in the 1990s. But other people gave statements to the FBI that if they looked around that area, they would, and out in the desert, they would begin to find the answers, that he was connected to people out in the desert who had answers, who were involved. And there was kind of an extensive search for these people. However, I think, as we'll see, that got quickly dropped to... So there was a chemist out in the desert, and this was a very highly trained chemist, and he was an extremely talented chemist. And according to some credible people, for instance, criminologist Mark Ham from Indiana State University, who says that actually this chemist played a much larger role in the bombing. And if, you know, there's a good book, it's called In Bad Company, and it kind of lays out the pack of wolves scenario. It doesn't go into all the other stories, but he makes a very good case. Anyways, he says that this man played a major role in the bombing, and both McVeigh and the chemist denied that they had ever had anything but very surface contact with each other. And this man, this chemist, who I'll tell you more about, he was arrested shortly after the bombing. He was arrested a few weeks after the bombing on an unrelated weapons charge.
But they were, sounded like they were watching him.
Well, yes, and he signs a proffer, and he's let go. And he was forgotten about. He was forgotten about except for, you know, like I said, a couple criminologists, a couple academics who kept looking at this and saying, yeah, you know, he's in there. He was forgotten about. Well, what I think is interesting is that this man then shows up in about 2010 on the UFO contactee circuit. Back up one second, I'm sorry. Not only is there speculation that this man had more contact with McVeigh, there were only two people authorized to pick up his mail out in Kingman, Arizona. One of them being Michael Fortier, who, you know, was ostensibly cleared, and the other one was this chemist. But also, there's the possibility that they shared storage sheds, which is where McVeigh was depositing all of his explosives equipment. And McVeigh himself said there are still storage sheds out there that they haven't found. Anyways, so this chemist, he shows up in about 2010 at MUFON and in other UFO contactee events. And
that's weird.
It is weird. It's weird, but guess what? Can you guess what his specialty is?
The chemist's specialty?
Yes, on the UFO circuit, 15 years later.
Oh, well, let's see. What could it be? Implanted chips?
Bingo. Right. So I also want to tell you this, that the way that this chemist met Timothy McVeigh was through some pretty high-level intelligence spooky people, and I'm talking Iran-Contra spooky. This is the international arms dealers, the person who hooked the chemist up with McVeigh. But so this man, his name is, should I name him or should I?
Well, has he been charged or convicted with anything yet?
He has never been charged with the bombing.
No, it's pass on his name for now.
Okay. He turns up, like you said, the MUFON conferences and the circuit, and his specialty is detecting and removing implanted surveillance chips that he says aliens put there.
Now, can we at least rule out a dear friend of ours who has died? His name was Roger Lear.
Well, he worked with Dr. Lear.
Okay.
But it wasn't Dr. Lear who was the chemist that I am talking about.
Right.
And so for a small fee, you can have him and his special equipment, a metal detector, detect and, I assume that now that Dr. Lear is passed away, that this chemist is not actively removing surveillance chips from people. But why I think this is interesting is your audience, some of them may be familiar with the book by Mark Pingleton, Mirage Men, or maybe Project Beta by George Bishop, who goes a long way in tracing the lineage of the disinformation campaigns that have been waged against the UFO contactee community, where, just being given some outrageous information in order to make people look crazy. Some people would kind of look at things that William Cooper said and trace, actually, I think Pinkleton and Greg Bishop, both of their books establish that things that come out later in books like Behold a Pale Horse by William Cooper can be directly traced to military intelligence operations. But so I got to wonder sometimes when people are talking about alien implant technology, if there really isn't something more earthly but darker going on.
Well, I'm convinced that there probably is, Wendy. And Holland, let me bring you in here for a second. In terms of motivation, let's make an assumption that, of course, McVeigh did this, Terry Nichols did this, but they might have had help, they might have had some pushing. Something was a little bigger here than what the public really knows and understands, issues that you two are trying to bring to the forefront here. What was the motivation to do this? Because after 95, what did they need this tragedy to do in order to move forward? I mean, they went into Iraq not really blaming Oklahoma at all in 2003, after Desert Storm, where you were probably based. What do you think the motivation was, if this is true, that they did these weird things?
Well, if we're going to look at it politically, you can look at the political environment in the 1990s. And it was much different from today because America had basically no external enemy besides the very truncated power of Iraq, which we had destroyed in the first Gulf War, which Tim McVeigh played a very bloody hand. He personally killed several Iraqi soldiers. And So basically, we were living in a world without enemies for the most part. Terrorism had not struck America. I know that is hard to imagine in America, but the America we grew up in, George, I know you're older than I, but the America that even Wendy and I grew up in as children, terrorism was something that happened overseas to strange people who talked funny. It didn't happen here. And when Oklahoma City happened, it was a blow to the heartland. It was a blow to the innocence of America. It transformed this country that basically laid the groundwork for the greater transformation of 9/11. But lately, information we have discovered may tie the Oklahoma City bombing into a proposed operation that the CIA was involved in 1995. In fact, March of 1995, in their own archived literature, they describe an operation that they said, in their own words, the CIA's own words, was as big as or the largest operation since the Bay of Pigs to overthrow Saddam. They were going to sponsor a coup in Iraq, isolate Saddam, and then they needed a reason to get boots on the ground to finish him off.
Yep.
Now, they were planning this coup, and security was compromised and it fell apart. Part of it executed without the other part knowing. It was just a big disaster, and it went nowhere. And frankly, the CIA support was canceled. But I believe that the Oklahoma City operation, what I'm following up on now, we don't have proof on this, is that the Oklahoma City bombing was originally supposed to be tied to Middle Eastern terrorists. And that explains the original script laid out by the government in the days after the bombing, saying this is Middle Eastern, this is Middle Eastern.
Mm-hmm.
Gun number two is Middle Eastern. And it was going to be tied to the neo-Nazi right because there were links between radical Islamic terrorism and neo-Nazis. They both hate the U.S. government, and they both hate Jewish people. Historically, there's a lot of collaboration between the neo-Nazis and radical Islamic movements, although it sounds kind of paradoxical at first. But these terrorist groups, they do cooperate. In fact, we have talked to people who were involved with the neo-Nazi right at that time who were exchanging information and assets with Middle Eastern terrorists. So I believe that this was supposed to be tied into the vast right-wing conspiracy, as Hillary later called it, to Saddam Hussein. It was going to be put on him as revenge for supporting the coup. We were going to have the bloody act in Oklahoma City to blame it on Saddam, then go into Iraq and basically finish up Iraq in 1995. But basically, that operation fell apart, and for some reason, the provocation operation, Oklahoma City, went forward. Maybe they were seeking some kind of payoff in demonizing the far right in this country. If you realize that, you know, President Clinton was in electoral peril in 1994, 1995, the Republican Revolution in 94 had really upset the apple cart, and he really had to face a possibility of perhaps being a lame duck president in his first term. And when asked once on Air Force One, what he attributed his victory, his somewhat surprising presidential victory, re-election in 1996, he said, the president himself said it was Oklahoma City, and it brought the country together.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right. And I find it strange that two guys could have loaded 5,000 pounds of ammonium nitrite and nitromethane in a truck. But let's talk more, and we're going to take calls, too. So those of you on hold, I'll get right to you on Coast to Coast AM when we come back. Well, we will get to your calls now. Those of you who have been on hold for a while, we'll get right to you as we talk about the really sad case of the Oklahoma City bombing, 21 years. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to our final segment with Wendy Painting and Holland Vanden Nieuwenhof as we talk about their work. Vanden's, of course, with Wendy's film called A Noble Lie, the website, anoblelie.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Wendy's book, Aberration in the Heartland of the Real, The Secret Lives of Timothy McVeigh, and that's lonewolfresearch.com. Now let's go to the calls, as promised, Richard in Des Moines, Iowa, to get us started. Richard, go ahead.
Hi, good morning, guys. I had a question. I heard that the Turner Diaries, the book, the Turner Diaries, had laid a blueprint that led McVeigh to commit this act. Did that hold any truth, or was that something that was made up?
Wendy, can you help him on that one?
It has been called a blueprint. McVeigh had a special attachment to that book. If you think about Chapman and others and their attachment to, let's say, Catcher in the Rye, it would be like that, almost an obsessive handing out of this book to anyone he would meet. Now, in public, he would say that he had no racist inclinations. For someone with no racist inclinations, he hung out with a lot of Nazi types. As far as a blueprint, I don't know, Holland, what do you...
Well, I think the book was provocational. It talks about, and frankly, I haven't read it. I really can't stand to read literature like that, so I read synopses of it. And it talks apparently about a revolt against the government, against the Zionist occupation government, and revolting against mixed racing and yada, 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 and this group of so-called patriots.
A lot of hate, right?
Yeah, they get together and they blow up federal buildings, basically. And McVeigh was passing this around, was basically telling people that this is what we need to do. But if he was acting as an agent provocateur, which we know one of his roles was, that fits perfectly right into it. Encouraging people to commit federal crimes so they can be arrested by federal law enforcement. And I'm not trying to impugn, as the government did, the far right in these crimes as a wholesale. Nor am I saying that the far right is alone in their persecution for their extremist beliefs. The far left spectrum is subject to at least as much harassment and surveillance and provocateur operations. I myself am a libertarian. So it's hard for me to read some of the things that I actually believe being perverted towards violent ends. But I think McVeigh was, in this role, was acting as a provocateur, getting people to commit violent acts so they could be arrested by the government. That's my opinion.
And if you think about the 1990s, that book was going around the gun show circuit. I mean, up until the time of the bombing, any gun show you went to would have had a copy of the Turner Diaries. So if you think of the thousands of people that picked that up along the way, you know, while it's a poorly written and very hateful, violent book, it's certainly, I would never want to be associated with a crime only because of the books. I own over 1,000 books. I would be in big, big trouble.
What did Timothy McVeigh do for a living prior to this bombing episode?
Well, he was like the A-team. He was traveling from adventure to adventure with no verifiable source of income.
That's strange, too, isn't it?
Certainly.
It is very much strange. It's an indicator that he perhaps was funded. I mean, he was living in hotel rooms. And, yes, they were cheap hotel rooms, but living in hotel rooms every night of your life, basically for 2 or 3 years, is not for poor people. And he rarely held a job for any length of time. And he was also just traveling around, apparently, by selling, T-shirts and basically army surplus knickknacks, which is, the math really doesn't add up on that.
How about Nichols? What did he do?
Terry Nichols was not an informant. Terry Nichols was an oftentimes failed farmer, but basically he was a farmer.
Hugh in Grants Pass, Oregon. Hello, Hugh. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Can you hear me, George?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, George, you've met me at Contact. I'm looking forward to seeing you again.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You're that Hugh.
Now, this is the reason, the people you have on tonight, this is the reason why I tried to talk to you to begin with. I've been trying to get Jim Mars to write my story, but he's been too busy. Timothy McVeigh was one of my neighbors in Michigan. And on my farm, there was a drug trade. Robert Tosh Pumley had a gun and drug trade, the CIA agent. And McVeigh, the first time I met him, he was buying LSD at the back of my ranch in Michigan, 23 mile on Van Dyke.
Know it well.
And this, just before I stopped at drug trade, I met McVeigh, and he was getting LSD. And I would submit to you that he was probably selling LSD because most of the dealers that stopped at my ranch were picking up LSD by the 100,000.
What year would that have been, Hugh?
80, 81. And the local dealers were selling to the auto companies. And none of those people are going to admit that because nobody's going to admit they were doing cocaine and LSD.
Did you say 1980 or 81?
What would that have made McVeigh? How old would he have been?
Yeah.
He
wouldn't have been out of high school yet.
Well, it might have been later than that, George.
Yeah, it had to have been. I mean, how old did he look to you at the time, Hugh?
My age.
Then?
Maybe 18 or 19 in his 20s. Now, I became a publisher in New York in 1983, ASCAP.
Okay.
And all of this is related, all of this. Okay, I lived next door to a John Nichols for 15 years. And then I divorced my wife, and I moved to Utica, Michigan, and Shelby, Michigan, two different farms.
Mm-hmm.
And in my absence, some people started a gun and drug trade on my farm. I was gone for 6 months, and the people I hired to watch my children started a gun and drug trade.
Oh, great.
And it was at that time, I come home, and I stop that trade, and that's when they chased Noriega into the Vatican. And this is when Robert Todd...
Oh, that's 1991, not 81.
Is that when that was?
Right, and that would have been 4 years before the tragedy in Oklahoma City. Did McVeigh spend time in Michigan, Holland? Do you know?
Say again?
Did McVeigh spend time in Michigan?
Oh, yes. Yes, he did.
Well, there it is.
He was linked to the bombing through an address he gave in Michigan.
He had written cryptic... this is what I mean about these spectral McVeighs that pop up all over the place, but... He had written actually a cryptic reference to his sister in one letter talking about an acid test. And so there was some indication that he, and I think he actually at one point does admit that he had tried acid. That's interesting story, except for that in 1991 he was still, at the peak of his Army career. So I wonder...
Well, Hugh, compile your information and send it to lonewolfresearch.com.
Sure thing.
Following up all tips.
Michael in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Let's get you in here, Michael. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you both. And my question is for Holland. This is the most patriotic audience in America right here, this coast-to-coast audience. And the reason why is because we want the facts. We want to be informed. We want to know what we have to do to save America and make it a better country. And it's people like the two of you, investigative reporters, who help us to do that. But we have to go a step farther than we have gone so far on coast to coast. We had a former federal prosecutor visit this show several times by the name of John Loftus. John talked to us. He was a Nixon's chief Nazi hunter back in
the day. I admire Loftus's work. I admire it.
Yes, yes. But John is out there telling us to back the CIA, to back the FBI, and yes, deal with the rogues, because he's with an organization of former and current FBI agents and CIA agents who get together in Florida every year and try to promote their fraternity. We've got to have born-again Christians following Jesus's command to carry a sword. The FBI and the CIA is our sword. So, yeah, let's dig into it. But, George, let's bring on the deep-rooted experts like John Loftus. Put them beside people like Holland and your other guests here tonight, and let's get to the root of how we solve these problems. The sting operations are extremely dangerous. I've been involved in them, and we're not telling the whole story.
It's out there, Michael, but you got to be careful. You know that. Cindy in the state of Washington. Hi, Cindy. Good morning.
I was just going to validate the fact, not that you need validation, but not you, but the information about being programmed. I've never, ever believed the McVeigh story. I never have, because I had, I'm kind of nervous, so anyway, trying to be quick too. In New York, where I grew up, I went through programming as a little tiny child, like a baby.
Who programmed you?
it was in the Yonkers area. I don't know. I just go through flashbacks, okay?
Okay.
I've been in counseling for 15 years, and what I do know is the program, it was child pornography thing.
Oh, God.
And
what time frame in the Yonkers area?
Yep.
When was this?
Only 2 miles away.
Cindy, when was this?
What's that?
When was this?
I was born in 54. That would have had been,
60?
No, way before that, because then we moved to Armonk. And if you know anything about, Hillary Clinton lives in Chappaqua, Chappaquiddick murders, remember those? Then we've got Pleasantville, but Armonk is only about 25 miles north of New York City. But from 1 to 3 years old, or maybe 2.5, I was in Yonkers. What happened? I only have flashbacks. But let me tell you, programming, the body memories never forget. Just like if a woman, man, whatever, takes ballet, you'll never forget those moves, ever. The body never forgets. And when I go through a flashback, it's really bad. So I know I'm going you're going, no, you're all over the chart. Yes, that's why I understand McVeigh. I do believe it was DID, only they produced it on purpose at an older age, which, by the way, is very difficult. Mine was done at a young age, which is so easy, and it goes with child trafficking. And
where were your parents, Cindy? I'm curious.
They're both dead, so I can say this, and I love them, but my father was the art director of American Home Magazine, and we were in it back in the early 90s.
I mean, did they know what was going on? They obviously had to.
Before we went to Armonk, I would say with my flashbacks, I would say, no, my father was not involved directly, but because he was so involved with the, I would say, low-level mafia, but I don't want to insult them. He owed something, and he gave it, and that was it.
But this is what I don't understand. I mean, you were one or 2 years old. How did they get to you?
No. 1.5 to maybe 2.
That's what I just said.
How
did they get to you?
Well, number one, I did go to a daycare center that my brother, who's 2 years older than me, which I'll be 62 this year, he'll be 64. He doesn't remember, excuse me, and he worked there and still lives in New York.
So it happened at a daycare center?
Well, I don't know.
Well, how do you know this even happened to you then?
Because with the flashbacks, and I have two women friends that were really good friends of mine. One has died from cancer since, but when she went to all my counseling appointments with my, Christian counselor, who doesn't charge me a dime, by the way.
Well, I think what you need to do is get some past life regression or something like that. A couple minutes left. Joe in the Bronx. Hi, Joseph. Go ahead.
George, how you doing?
Good.
Good show. I'd like to ask either Holland or Wendy if they believe speculatively that perhaps Oklahoma City could have a tie-in with 9/11 as far as acclimating Americans to trauma of that sort.
I can see that both of them were media spectacles who over time have proven to have huge gaps in the stories that we are told, and like you said, acclimated the general public to accept repressive legislation and measures that you would have thought previously would have been unimaginable. In fact, right after the Oklahoma City bombing, the omnibus counterterrorist bill was passed. With overwhelming support. Now, Clinton had been trying to pass this through prior to the bombing, and he was getting a lot of flack, and it wasn't going through. Immediately, within months after the bombing, this passes unanimously. Everything that's in the Omnibus Counterterrorist Act is later in the Patriot Act, but kind of on steroids. So, I mean, that's what I would say about that. Holland?
Yeah, Oklahoma City was indeed basically breaking new ground to be fully exploited by 9/11. It was a beta test in the fact that they learned what they could get away with.
And two years after the initial bombing of the World Trade Center, which was in 93, right?
Yes, but that terrorist attack had largely, frankly, been a bomb. It only had killed half a dozen people. It did no major damage. There were, you know, no one was scared by that attack because those towers are so huge and vast that a little tiny truck bomb did basically nothing.
Right.
It did collapse one level of a parking garage. That was basically it. But people were not scared about the first World Trade Center attacks in 93. It was barely even mentioned in the narrative. It just didn't go anywhere. But with Oklahoma City, it did. With that body count, it sent the message home. And it's not just about a metaphor. We have people who benefited, who worked on Oklahoma City, who were later rewarded to this day. For example, Wendy mentioned the omnibus crime bill. That was introduced by Joe Biden at behest of the Clinton presidency. He's now vice president. We have now Garland Merrick being nominated for the Supreme Court. Well, he was in the Justice Department during the 1990s, and he was in charge of the cover-up into Oklahoma City. He made his bones there. Now he's being rewarded.
Hmm.
We can only fear what his judicial legacy is going to be should he achieve that office, given that he made his bones as a cover-up artist for mass murder. So in many ways, it does tie in, not just metaphorically, but in real life.
You know what? The first World Trade Center, 93, that also involves an informant. And all three, OKC, 9/11, and the first World Trade Center bombing in 93 involved informants.
And 93 involved a Ryder truck.
Right.
What is amazing about this, they kept on pitching the same script time and again.
Over and over again. Well, thank you, both of you. Good luck with your work. The film, A Noble Lie, the book, Aberration in the Heartland of the Real. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment with more on Coast to Coast AM.